Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, risk and return. Before we get to that, we'll have a happy look at the numbers and talk about the geopolitics that is driving stock prices and all of that. The upshot is that we had a strong bull day. It's not quite over yet, but this is one of those days where, as you can see, as usual, the Dow is up the least, lowest risk, and then the S&P 500 is up more, almost. The Dow was up a little more than a quarter of a percent, the S&P 500 up almost a 1%, and the NASDAQ is just raging. You notice that by that spark chart, there was a sell-off a little while ago. It was a good solid gain, big day, and then there was a hardcore maybe an hour ago or so, and it's bounced right back from that. But that was kind of a downer. There was a lot of excitement about the what was going on in the other parts of the world. There were some rumors swirling that probably didn't have any basis at all, but they were there. Crude oil has slid more than I would have expected. And I've got a couple of different explanations that have been given to me. One is, that kind of creeps me out, is that the expectation that the supply of oil, global supply of oil, was going to be curtailed significantly by banning the oil out of Russia. I had some fellow who is in the oil industry said, they're not going to stop that oil. They're not going to stop it. It's going to keep going. And apparently that sentiment is kind of becoming what everyone's thinking. No, there's not going to be a restriction in the supply of oil. So there's that. Now, if you look at the S&P 500, this was a strong day, but at the same time, the typical day, we're almost at the end of the day now, the typical day over the past year has been 3.7 billion shares. And today, we're probably going to get about 2 billion shares. So in other words, even though this is a rally, it is not a broad-based rally where all hands are on deck. There is still a lot of money being held back. But we have a bull day. If we look over here, gold and silver had a bad day. So in other words, money was coming out of the metals, heading into securities. Let's see the bonds. And the yield on the 10-year bond is up, which means the price is down, which means that those are being sold by investors. So investors are getting out of the safety of metals and bonds, and they are going into the risk of stocks. That's bull sentiment. That's bull territory. How long it will last is another thing. Now, the FTSE had a good, strong day up. In London was doing good today. It had a nice, smooth ride up through most of the day, as you can see by the spark chart. Same was true of the Nikkei on the other side of the world last night. It was up a good, strong 1 2/3%. So we've got a decent sentiment going on right now, positive sentiment, and even oil is going down in price for the time being, but that, whether that translates into lower gas prices is going to be a little bit speculative. I won't get into that right now. But anyway, let me see something here. Okay, now, here's the downside. I had shown you about yield curves, and I pointed this out on Monday, and I put a post up on LinkedIn about this as well. If you look at the yield curve chart, there on the 11th, we had the inversion. The 7-year was higher than the 10-year by one basis point. That's a technical inversion. Well, yes, the next one, yep, we've got an inversion again. It's holding, and it's still holding as of yesterday. So we do have it wasn't a fluke. It wasn't a glitch. We have an inverted yield curve. That means that we based on other factors that are adding in, we will have a recession within 6 to 9 months. Moderate, I don't see it as being severe, but we will have a moderate recession. This is clear. The yield curve is holding in the inverted position. So, like I said, that means it wasn't just a quick one-off. It's there, and it is definitely signaling that a recession is on the horizon. So keep that in mind when you're making your plans for the future here, is that we are in a situation where the economy is fragile. It's growing strongly, and unemployment is historically low. But we do have a problem with inflation. The Fed is raising short-term interest rates to fight off the inflation and the expectation of inflation. So that's going to slow down the economy. How much? Well, the yield curve says it'll be enough. Now, let me say this. I don't know how much they emphasize it in macroeconomics here. A recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. And so so if we pause, that could be one negative and then it comes back to positive, or it could be a couple of quarters of zero growth. That's not a recession. A recession is when you have two consecutive quarters of the GDP, in other words, the economy contracting. Get ready for it. It's coming. Risk and return. And I've talked about risk previously in the course on a number of occasions, building up to now where we formally introduce risk to you. And this is where it happens. The first thing, and I'm going to repeat some of what I've said before, and I'm going to make an exception to how it's presented in your textbook. Risk is the potential variation in outcomes that could happen. How many different outcomes there could be? There's no risk if there's only one thing that could happen. So in other words, you will die. There's no risk there. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I've been told not to hurt feelings anymore. But as he drops his pencil, don't worry, it won't happen. Maybe it will. I don't know. You see, here's the thing, though, is that risk is variation in outcomes. However, that's a little bit too simplistic as far as talking about risk goes. And it certainly won't do for us to talk about risk just that way, qualitatively, in a finance course. We need numbers. We need to be able to put a number on the risk. And in our business, that number is probably going to be an amount, a dollar amount. What is this risk going to cost us? If there's low risk, then we don't have much of a cost. If there's high risk, we have a cost. About 5 years ago, maybe six, I took my students from the finance club down to St. Louis. There's an insurance company down there. Most people know them as personal lines, car and home insurance, life insurance. But they actually have a huge commercial operation where they're insuring commercial risk, insuring companies against commercial exposures, as we say. Well, they brought in their top dogs down there to talk to the students. Say, okay, here's what you would do if you get an internship or you take a job with us. You will actually, after a training period, you will spend not even half of your time sitting behind a desk playing with Excel or something like that. You'll be on one day, you might be walking along a barge on the Mississippi, identifying all the different risk exposures, quantifying how severe they are, and then you will figure out what the price of each of those risks is. You'll add them up, and that will be the premium we will charge, plus something for taking on that risk. That's what we'll charge. Another day, you might be 10 stories up on the skeleton of a high-rise that's going up, walking along, looking at electrical outlets, looking at all the different parts of the building, and identifying them, listing them, and then pricing them. That's what you'll be doing. I had one long-ago student, she's now an executive, described how one time she actually walked across the catwalk of a rendering facility. Now, if you don't know what a rendering facility is, that's where they throw dead animals and they cook them slowly down to fat. And so then that fat goes into the food you eat or the soap that you wash with and all that. And apparently it was the most, for her, it was the most ungodly smell she had ever experienced. For me, that would tell me bacon is cooking, but, you know, that's just me. But anyway, again, it just gives you an idea. Now, so we have to look at the variety of risks, and there is a crucial division in finance. It's most often expressed in your insurance class. I'll talk a lot about this difference in types of risk. There is frequency versus severity. Now, I want to show you this with a demonstration. Sir, come on. You, I want you to walk up here. Now, I want you to tell me, what are these?
Rubber chickens.
They're little rubber chickens. But these aren't just any chickens. These are angry little chickens. Bawk, 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 bawk! Did that hurt?
No.
Were you damaged at all?
No.
Emotionally, maybe.
I'm in pain.
Now, suppose instead of those little chickens, which happen every day, you walk outside, oh God, here come those chickens again. I hate this. Instead, one day in your life, a giant chicken dinosaur comes at you. No, wait. It's a fire-breathing chicken dinosaur. Oh, God! Ouch! Damn it. Happened only once in your life. Frequency low, severity high. Frequency high, severity low. Do you see the difference in those two risks? They're fundamentally different. You will never be hurt by those chickens. But this one, we're talking, well, actually, barbecue chicken. I almost caught myself on fire there, but you know what I mean. Thank you. And I guarantee you that is the only time you'll ever see chickens attack a student in class. Ever. Give you some more realistic examples here. The attacks upon the United States on September 11th, 2001, they targeted the World Trade Center. Now, those were enormous skyscrapers. Imagine how likely it would be, or unlikely it would be, for those two towers to be catastrophically damaged. It's impossible. Even one of them would be a highly, highly unlikely event. So the insurance was only on one of the two towers. And there you go. Both of them got hit. Sort of like the story I tell of the time long ago, on a highway, I saw some young man hitchhiking. So I picked him up and I said, come on in. And he got in. He was very grateful. He said, I really appreciate you picking me up like this. You know, I could be a serial killer. And I said to him, well, what would be the chance that there would be two serial killers in the same car? He asked to get off at the next exit. Go ahead.
I thought with the two towers that it was actually they considered, so the two towers were connected by a basement.
Yes. That was the argument that was made. They actually argued that, and if I understand right, they said, no, not for this circumstance. The information I got was from March and McClung had Their main office there, and all their executives, or a lot of them, were wiped out that day. And they said that the argument was that that would be under a normal circumstance, but the structures themselves, they could insure and indemnify the basement area, but the structure itself was not in the contract considered to be a single structure. It was too, because each one was under its own support piers. It's a disputed issue, but you're right, there was a lot of argument, a lot about this. Another one that is a good example is, as I've told you before, here in the Midwest, there is an ancient fault line that hardly ever breaks every couple of centuries. And so the frequency of occurrence of a destructive earthquake here in the Midwest is very low. But if one happens, the historical data says it is spectacular. The last one was in the early 1800s, and I mean the descriptions were just god-awful. The earthquake was so powerful, it heaved the water of the Mississippi back up north, and then it came down as a tsunami. So frequency, extremely low. Severity, staggeringly high. The same is true with an asteroid strike. It's very unlikely that we will have one that would be of insane destructiveness. But if we did... Well, it depends on where it hits. There are some places I just don't like, so it's okay with me. But anyway, where am I going with this? I'm going to the point that we need to be able to measure risk. With stock securities, for example, we would want something that is measuring volatility, ups and downs. But the price up and down would not be our best way to do it. We would need something that was more like this. A dollar up and a dollar down on a $10 stock is a lot more volatility than a dollar up and a dollar down on a $100 stock. So we need to make sure that we are using a data point. All of our data points are in some way able to be comparable across scale of operations or scale of numbers and all that. But anyway, the first thing that we have to start with in this is, there it is, a central tendency. Now, we can talk about the expected value of some random variable x, and I don't want to push too much, but random variables are essentially the globe of all data points that could happen. Okay, so the expected value would be the sum from the first data point to the nth, our last one, of the probability of each one occurring times the value of that data point. Now, I'm going to write some fancy terminology here. It looks good in your notes. It makes it look like you're doing something fancy. This is actually reduces to of a plain old average if P sub I equals P sub j, the probabilities are for all I not equal to j. In other words, that's a fancy way of saying, look, if all the probabilities are the same, you just add them up and divide by the number of points. It's an average. In real practice, if you have a limited amount of data, it might very well be that you can assign probabilities to each of the points in the data. Let me give you an example here. Suppose that we had a projection of next quarter GDP. And we had a very bad, a bad, and on the other side, we had a good and a very good. And we assign probabilities to each of those. And I put these data points up in an Excel sheet here because I'm going to show you a stupid Excel pet trick here. Okay? Now, on the first one, we have a probability of a very bad economy is 0.15. Oh, and one in the middle here where it's neither bad nor good. It's sort of like, meh, whatever. It's nothing big. Okay? And GDP for that one is negative 5%. GDP contracts really badly. For a bad one, we would say, maybe about a negative 2%. And there's a probability, a somewhat higher probability of that one, of 0.20%. A middle economy that's not really spectacular either way, we're up 1%. And then, and that has a probability of about 0.25%. 0.25, I'm sorry. And a good economy, we have, that would be one where we have a growth of 2%. And that one has a probability of about 0.3. And a very good economy that would be up about 4%. That has a probability of about 0.10%. This is not as simplistic as it looks. A lot of economic forecasting is done starting with a chart like this. Usually it's got a lot, maybe twice as many scenarios as this does, but that is actually a rather... What is this? Get off me. Damn it. I've tried to kill this. And I don't know how yet. I bought that phone. I don't know how to stop it. Okay, here we go. I apologize for that. Okay. Okay, where am I? Okay. Now, to do this, we would... say the expected value, and usually we use an GDP with a little bar over it, says average, the expected value. And in this case, we would do 0.15 times a negative 5% plus a 0.20 times a negative 2%. Plus a 0.25 times a 1%, positive 1%, plus a 0.30 times a positive 2%, plus a 0.10 times 4% times positive 4%. And you just do that math. Now I'm going to do this, and I think I showed you this before, but I'll show it to you again. It's a nice, nice trick in Excel called the sum product. The mean, that's a fancy word for the expected value or the average. I would want to do, let me put the, clean those numbers up a little bit here. Okay, matter of fact, let me just do it this way. Format the numbers, give them all 2 decimal places. Okay, now, sum product does this. It's a neat little trick. Equals sum product of this column by with a comma, this column. There you go. That fast. Instead of doing that routine where I, in the last class, I just blew it. I just could not calculate it worth a darn. But this is some proc, and we're going to use it again here in a minute. This is a powerful tool for being able to do expected values where you have different probabilities of the different events. Okay, that tells us what is called central tendency, where we most likely expect it to land. That's not where it will, probably, but this is where we expect it to land. Now, the problem here comes in that we still need to measure risk, the spread of outcomes. How widely could the outcome vary? So for that, we need the variance, which is a real pain in the backside. It is the sum from I equals 1 to 10 of each probability times that each data point minus the expected value squared. And let me tell you, doing that, if you've got a big data set, is a pain in the butt. I won't even do it with this one. I don't have to. If you've got the sum product down, the first thing that I would want to do is take each data point minus the expected value, which is this mean. Now, I'm going to make that an absolute reference by hitting F4. That way, when I sweep the formula down, copy it down, it will hold that value in C7, the mean, right there, instead of going down as I go down with the column. So, why don't I just do it all at once? I'm going to take each data point minus the mean, and I'm going to square it. Just like that. And then I'm going to sweep that down so that I can get every one of each data point minus the mean squared. And then I can just do a sum product equals sum product of the probabilities column. Probabilities column by the squared differences column. There you go. That fast. Now, I emphasize that if you have a big data set like 50, 100 points, this is a bacon saver for that. Because there is a variance function in Excel, but that assumes that all of the data points have the same probability. Here, you can use this if the data points have different probabilities of occurrence. Now, here's the problem with variance. It does measure spread, but it is not in the same units as our GDP data. It's the squared units. So what we do is we take the square root of the variance, and there's your Uncle Bob. That seems like a kind of a big number, but geez. Okay, one way or the other, there it is. Now, what does this tell us? One thing to point out is this is in the right units. It's a measure of spread. in the same units as the original data was. That's why we like it. It does a nice thing for us. Here's the thing, though, is that what do we do with this? What is this useful for? If a distribution is sort of close to being like a bell curve. Now, this one isn't. Do you see that this is not a symmetric distribution? Do you see those probabilities? They're not exactly symmetric. But we're going to say if it is close to being like a bell curve, a normal, here's what we know about normal distributions. 67% of the time, the data will be between the average minus one standard deviation and the data average plus one standard deviation, 67% of the time. Has nothing to do with this data set itself. It has to do with just the actual how normal distributions work. Whatever the normal distribution is, 67% of the data will lie in this fat piece right here, from one standard deviation below to one standard deviation above. In fact, we can even go further. 94 to 95% of the time, the data will be between the standard deviation, the expected value minus two standard deviations and the expected value plus two standard deviations. That's kind of useful. I'm going to show you an actual example from my own corporation. Now, these numbers are smoothed out. They weren't exactly this. But the expected value of my revenues from the art show season for the last 5 years, which is a sucky set of data, but that's what I have, was $12,500 approximately. You add up the year's revenues and divide by five. That was what it was. And the standard deviation was about $3,100. I mean, this was just Excel. I did this. As a matter of fact, I just added another data point. I was doing my taxes for the last year, and I decided I'd run it. I put this one in. So I know that there is about a 67% chance that my revenues next year, if everything stays the same, they will be somewhere between $9,400 and $15,600. There's a 67% chance that it'll fall in there. There's about a 94% chance that they'll be between $6,300 and $18,700. Okay, that's nice. It's a little more interesting information, but let me tell you how I actually use this. I have to buy new equipment for a new year, and I'm going from steel grid display struts to pro panels, which are rather expensive. They're going to cost me about $5,000. Okay. I'm 94% sure that I'll be able to cover them. If they had been like $7,000, I would have said, I'm not. I want to be about 95% sure that I can do this and not go into negative profit. And there it is. These numbers aren't exactly it. They were, you know, it was But it was like this, and I said, okay, it's a go, because even there's a good chance, a very good chance, a 94-95% chance that I'll have more revenue than those pro panels will cost me. That is applying this to real business. That's how nice this kind of statistics. It's one of the rules that I learned long ago when I was in probability theory. You either use the most complicated statistics in the world or you use the simplest statistics in the world. Either one's going to give you good information. Use anything in the middle and you're probably going to get crap. And this is simple stuff, and it gives me something, and it tells me, buy this. It's a decision-making number. So that gives you a little idea of why we care about this kind of stuff. Now, where does this put us in stocks? We have to talk about risk, and our first risk measure is standard deviation. The problem with standard deviation is that it measures total risk. Now let me say this. The terminology that I'm going to give you a couple of different terms for the same things here. Total risk has two pieces to it. Now, total risk is our go-to is standard deviation. Now, that's where we stop in a lot of areas of business, is standard deviation. Or there's a twist on it called coefficient of variation, which I'll show you on Friday. But, I mean, that's our go-to. But in finance, it's specifically in investments, we can't stop there because we know that total risk has two pieces. On the one hand, okay. It has become popular in the last 5 years in textbooks in finance to use a term for total risk called standalone risk. I'm still not quite comfortable with it. But, you know, it's there. We have better words for this. It's total risk, standard deviation, or you'll see in the book, standalone risk. It's the overall risk of this company with all of its internal and external factors played into it. The internal factors, the management, the types of facilities that they have, all those kinds of things go into standalone risk, plus all of the macroeconomic factors out there. So now we have to break that up into two kinds of risk. There is this risk that is company specific. Now, other terms for this that you would see in other courses, and I have kind of an obligation because I know that the finance words are different. The one that we use in finance, we would say it's non-systematic risk. It's not part of the system of the world. It's just that company. It's Tesla, the part of Tesla that is Elon Musk. It is the part of Hughes Aircraft that was Howard Hughes and all of his craziness. It was the part of a company like Enron that was the corruption of its officials. Another word you'll see sometimes is peculiar or pecuniary. That's another one. I've even seen parochial risk. Another term in finance is diversifiable risk. as I'll go into on Friday, you can make this risk go away. You just buy more different stocks so that the different weirdnesses of each company will cancel each other out over time. The weirdness of an Elon Musk will be canceled out by the weirdness of the CEO of Nikola or another, or a Rivian, that kind of thing. We can get rid of it. We can make it go away by getting cancellation effect from different stocks, sort of smoothing out all of those company-specific risks. Now, on the other hand, the other risk part is the macroeconomic. How does the world impact on this? Because if this kind of risk is affecting all companies, we can't get rid of it. It's going to be there, moving all of the stocks around. So that's why we call it the systemic risk. It is part of the system of the world, the systemic risk. Other terms that you will see for this kind of risk. I've even seen this term, world risk. Another one in finance, as well as systematic, is this is the non-diversifiable risk. You can't make it go away by simply buying other stocks because they'll be swinging with this risk altogether at different levels. Put those two together and you've got the total risk, the sigma. Now, here's the trick that we need to do is we need to be able to tease those two apart from each other. Because the only risk that you are going to expect to get rewarded for is the risk that you can't get rid of. Markets do not have any patience at all for people who are stupid enough to take on company risk. We don't need that. And that is what we, when we walk from the idea of the day traders and the speculators over to the world of responsible investors for themselves, for their families, for their corporations, and for pension funds and all that. We are not in the business of taking this risk. We need to know what it is so that we can know how to get rid of it, because the only reward that we can expect is for that risk over there, the systemic risk, the systematic risk. I should write that here. Put this on your notes. Sometimes it's called systematic. Now, the systematic risk. The total risk is that diversifiable risk plus the non-diversifiable. Risk. We don't even actually have a letter, a Greek letter for that diversifiable risk. Well, okay. Yes, we do. And I teach that in derivatives classes where it's all about risk. But the non-diversifiable risk, we use a metric called beta. That thing that I've been showing you all along, I'll even show you how to calculate betas. It's really not that hard to calculate betas. But beta is... It's a standardized metric. A beta equal to zero means that there is no systematic risk. A beta equal to 1.0 means that systematic risk is exactly the same as the world market. Now, I put the world in portfolio because oftentimes we just say the market. So, a treasury bill has a beta of exactly zero. It has no systematic risk. That does not mean that it does not have risk. You see them go, I was just showing you those go up and down, T-bills do, in price and yield. So, but what we are saying is that in a well-diversified portfolio, it offers, it adds no risk to the portfolio. This one here, a beta of one. If I see a stock with a beta of one, that does not mean it is exactly as risky as the world. It's systematic risk. It's non-diversifiable risk is the same as the world portfolio, the market portfolio. Now, know this on a quiz and the final. I am telegraphing a question. I'll say a stock with a beta of 1 has the risk of the market. That's false. It has the non-diversifiable, the systematic risk of the market, but the risk, the total risk could be insane. I can show you stocks that have betas of exactly 1. Bam, right on the button. Those things are crazy risky. But the risk, most of the risk, is diversifiable. You put it into a well-diversified portfolio, and it goes down to being a pussycat. It's just the same as the world portfolio. So in other words, if you took a bunch of stocks with betas of 1 and put them into a portfolio together, then the portfolio would have a beta of 1. It would have the systematic risk, the overall risk, actually, of the world. So that is where we do this. And then on Friday, I will show you the rest of the story. How do we get betas and how do we interpret them? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.